The Visioneers, Episode 10, The Scrooge Experience.
Well, now we come to one of the key events in the book, The Scrooge Experience. It's based on the story by Charles Dickens of The Christmas Carol. And Dickens is on hand to act as the MC. Oh, that's really clever.
Yes, it's one of the ways that the book came together.
This is powerful and terrible. The listener needs to get ready.
It's sad, you know, that a visit to humanity's past, present, and probable future should be like that. But of course, the Visioneers want to change the final act to make that future much more attractive than the way it's likely to be.
Actually, the way Charles Dickens tells it, early civilization was benign and energizing. Now, as he describes the story and the scenes, they come up as moving holographic images for all to see in the visioneering room. So you have to imagine that with your mind as we go.
From what we can tell, this was an age where war had little meaning, and men and women lived as true partners. The earth was rich and bountiful, and spiritual life centered on devotion to nature. Time was not measured here at all, but passed, not as we know it in jagged bursts of uncertain years for a single generation, but as millennia flowing smoothly on. We believe from the archaeological records that communities like these existed throughout the world. Now, as the millennia passed from Paleolithic to Neolithic times, a growing spiritual force among these people was the worship of the goddess. In various forms, she appeared as a transcending faith, a symbol and source of nourishment like the earth. The apex of this way of life was the island of Crete, where for 4,000 years an agricultural society flourished, worshipping the goddess and embracing the arts of pottery making, weaving, metallurgy, engraving, architecture, and all crafts contributing to a joyful artistic way of life. But elsewhere, outside, perhaps from marginal lands, another human element had developed. Nomadic bands of warlike marauders, discovering these great civilizations of peace and prosperity, came thrusting down upon them with another mentality. And thus began the era from which we have drawn most of our understanding of human interaction. Into the Neolithic civilizations of old Europe, swarms of invaders came from the Asiatic and European Northeast, bringing with them a ruling caste of warrior and priest, worshipping male gods of war and conquest, sweeping aside the gentle partnership of prosperity in the societies where the goddess had been central.
Well, Dickens then paints a graphic picture for the world leaders of the way that man's inhumanity to man became the way of the world. He continues right up to his own time, about which he wrote with such passion.
For I have walked the streets of London among the laboring poor. I have known the soul-crushing despair of being a laboring hind myself in a blacking factory. I have sat and talked with the wretched outcasts of the streets and visited their hideous dwelling places. I could not call them homes. I have seen the poor dear children, wretched and starving, and I have gathered them in my arms, as filthy as they were, crying and shivering in the bitter cold, neglected by their mothers in their drunken stupors. I saw it all. And it choked me until I almost could not bear it. I wanted to scream out the infamy of such a system to the world of sensibility and pleasure that rushed along a pace outside of all of this. But I, poor devil too, depended on that world for my own support. I could not write about the evil as it was, but I did the best I could. I created poor innocent wretches like my Joe, the street crossing sweeper. No father, no mother, no friends. Knows only that a broom's a broom. In these frail creatures I poured out to a barely conscious reading public all of the filth and poverty and ignorance and disease that infected the people on the lowest rungs of society in our great empire.
By now Dickens is so overcome with the recollection of the images that he is sobbing loudly. He is huddled at one corner of an abject street scene in London of the 1850s where men, women, and children in ragged clothes are tottering about in filth and refuse. For a moment, the orphan Joe appears with a pathetic broom. Dickens reaches out to him, but then the scene is gone and Dickens is left alone, still sobbing loudly and unable to continue.
And then Winston Churchill comes on to continue the narration, and he brings us up to the 20th century, which he outlines began with great promise, but has turned out to be more terrible than anyone could have imagined. And for Churchill, it culminated in the horror of Nazi Germany.
Churchill is now standing squarely facing the assembly. Behind him, the hooked cross of the swastika is fluttering on a flagpole. With terrible intensity, he now focuses every word on his audience.
You all know the story, or think you do, but I severely doubt that anyone can have an appreciation of the barbarism that would have prevailed had we not been victorious against these monsters. As Churchill continues to speak, a sudden unexpected change swoops upon the assembly. They are gripped, each one, by an invisible force and propelled out of their seats down toward the center of the room. Cries of fear and rage erupt, but there's no resisting the force that pushes them. When an evil power comes in the night and hauls you out of your house and herds you like animals into a waiting cattle car and transports you away out of sight to a concentration camp.
The leaders are now all huddled in terror in the center of the room under the waving swastika. Suddenly, they are stripped of their clothes and dressed in drab prison costume. They look at each other in abject fear and struggle to get away. But there's a force field around, holding them where they are.
When you are subjected to beatings and forced out into the work parties, when you hear machine gun fire and some members of your party don't return, when you hear reports of gas chambers and some of your family and friends are taken away and don't return, when you live like this every day in terror and deprivation, then you have some sense of how mad the world can be when decency and honor are abandoned, when good men and women stand by and do nothing while evil has its way.
As Churchill finishes speaking, a volley of machine gun fire rips out. Men and women are screaming and battling with each other to get away, but they are powerless to do so. A siren goes off, continues loudly for a minute, and then stops abruptly. In the silence that immediately follows, the unmistakable hissing sound of gas under pressure is heard, and clouds of vapor appear over the heads of the huddled group. For many of them, this is almost too much, and they drop to the floor crying, trembling in total and undisguised panic. Then, just as suddenly as it began, the ordeal is over. The leaders are dressed again in their own clothes, and the same force that propelled them from their place now returns them to it. Churchill stands alone in the center of the room.
As terrible a time as that was, we could perhaps have taken some solace from it if it had seemed to end the madness. But the world has run a full half century since then and still has not found the way to live with itself. Toward that end, you are all now allegedly engaged. What you've just heard and experienced in your own being should tell you that you cannot do it if you continue with the old ways of thinking still in place. Change them now, for each time the world goes to the brink is more terrible than the last, and one day there will be no way back.
As he utters these prophetic words, Churchill turns and walks away. John Kennedy takes his place. Charles Dickens sits wistfully at the side. Kennedy speaks solemnly to the assembly.
This is the city of Hiroshima, August 6, 1945, preparing for expected attack by American bombers. They're planning a long protracted defense to protect their homeland yard by yard. It will be the bitter legacy of their scurrilous and treacherous attack on Pearl Harbor 3.5 years earlier, and their savage warmongering around the Pacific Ocean in the years that followed. They will pay the consequences, but the manner in which that penalty will be exacted will forever change the course of human civilization.
Suddenly, an air raid siren goes off. The onlookers in the visioneering room leap in their seats. But the people in the scene pay little attention. Some of them look up to the sky, shielding their eyes against the bright sunlight. Seeing nothing, they shrug their shoulders, joke with their neighbors, and continue with what they were doing. After a minute or two, the siren stops, and a deep silence fills the room.
Into this space then erupts the forces of hell let loose on Earth. Everyone in the visioneering room is swept into it. The onlookers, the heads of state of great and small nations on Earth, experience everything, but without the consequences of the poor wretches in the scene portrayed. First, there is a great blinding flash of light, as if the sun had burst in the eyeballs of anyone caught watching. Following hard comes a rushing wind, dry and searing, more ferocious than 1,000 tornadoes attacking at once, sucking and tearing at the terrified spectators, but not lifting them from their seats. Down below, it's a different story. Everyone and everything is blown away. Just one great sweeping, howling bellow of sound and heat. Total annihilation. And the heat. Oh, the terrible, searing intensity of the heat. Instant incineration for the people in the scene, but a life-in-death experience for the onlookers, feeling the blood-boiling intensity of the explosion, but still sitting there, watching, unable to escape or die, while the blinding light savages their eyes, and the tumultuous roar of the wind buffets their eardrums and tears at their bodies, and a great inferno of flames and unbearable heat tries to consume their bodies.
Finally, the scene passes, and an unbelievable stillness fills the room. Every one of the spectators, participants of this first taste of Armageddon, is transfixed by the horror of it all. Sitting in their seats, white knuckles gripping the desks, they are inwardly traumatized to the point of collapse. Some are shaking visibly, others are weeping openly, still more sitting bolt upright, immobile, trying to comprehend the horror of it all. Together, Kennedy and Churchill bring us up to the end of the century. They describe the Cold War. They describe how it collapses only because of economics, not because of any newfound love of peace. They tell of the Gulf War and the brutal tribalism in Europe. Churchill summarizes.
So, at the end of the century, the nations still play as keenly in the theaters of war as they did at the beginning. While there has been a mass revulsion against the idea of war, the mind frame for promoting it is still in place as surely as it has been for the last 7,000 years.
Well, now they get into interaction with the world leaders. Some of them don't like being reminded of this. Finally, Kennedy explodes with a ringing speech.
There's more than 150 of the most enterprising minds in the world in here, and outside there are more than 5 billion others waiting for you to show that you can put forward a vision for life on this planet that isn't a thickening fog of despair and gloom. People want light and hope and joy in working for something they can truly believe in. The task here is to put your 150 minds together to come up with the vision that you can take back out to the assembly and say to the people of the world, of every nation on earth, this is what your leaders stand for. Now, will you work with us to put it in place? That's the task, ladies and gentlemen. We've begun by showing you the inevitable outcome if you continue down the path of those who have gone before. If you persist with policies that give sovereign states the right to commit atrocities within their borders, if you allow them to build up arms to attack their neighbors and threaten the world, if you step away from your immortal responsibility to preserve life on the planet, if this is all that you can do, then may God protect the people from the future that you have chosen.
At President Kennedy's last words, a clap-like thunder splits the air, and the room shakes violently in an earthquake. For what seems an eternity, the shuddering tumult continues, as men and women cry out in terror, grasping for whatever they can hold and diving for protection to the floor. Then, just as suddenly as it came, the uproar ceases. A swirling landscape of buckled earth and lowering sky sweeps into the room. Charles Dickens' theatrical voice rings out.
You have felt the Armageddon of the atom, but that's only one path of hell from the past. Now you must look to the earth itself. If it were to gather its voice in one loud protest against what men do, then it would quake and roar with a ferocity the like of which you can't imagine. See here, look at it, churning, churning, churning in its torment, land, sea, sky, all in protest. We have taken the magnificence of the human mind, all of its potential for creative brilliance, and thrown it headlong into the face of nature. From a heritage of awesome wonder, we have torn out with ever-growing technological power and recklessness what we have thought we needed for lives of quality. Look here, the magnificent sweep of forest and fertile plains, oceans and lakes alive with life, air clear and clean, night skies brilliant with stars. All this we had for countless millennia, an abundance so magnificent it had no end. But now look, look here, see what we have done with it. Sprawling cities, jungles of concrete, roaring traffic, clouds of fumes, all of it multiplied and multiplied, then multiplied again, until even the immensity of the oceans and the giant membrane of the atmosphere are not large enough to contain the volume of it. And look, look here at the consequences, samples of what we know, small indicators of the immensity we don't know, names and scenes familiar to all of you, because this is not the future. It's the present and the past, and it's the past piled upon the past, built into the present you don't like, leading to the future you don't want to think about. Look at them now. Do you remember? Nuclear catastrophe at Chernobyl, the oil spill of the Exxon Valdez, the oil fires of Kuwait, the spreading desert in North Africa, the disappearing rainforest in South America, the thick brown air of Mexico City, the gray forests of Europe and the dead lakes in Canada, the blighted landscapes of North America, the spreading cloud over China, the depleted fish stocks in tidal waters everywhere. Need we go on? This is your past, present, indicating future. 6 million years of heritage are being swept away in a few generations of the 20th century. Such is the tyranny of compounding disaster. Such is the enormity of our ignorance. Such is the challenge of this generation to turn the tide before everything worth having is gone.
And into this terrible space steps the gentleness of Anne, symbolizing all of the gentle people of the world who are being brutalized by what is happening to the planet. Hello. My name is Anne, and I have a dream. It's a special dream. A golden green, crimson vein dream, a very dream of dreams. I would like to share it. Please forgive me if I falter a little. I'm really very nervous, but if you just bear with me, I know I'll find the words because I must. I mean, what I have in my heart is crying out to be spoken. I feel I don't know. I'm so afraid, yet so hopeful. My mind is full of everything. Please, may I speak with you, all the important people. May I tell you what's in my heart, the heart of a young person, speaking for, I think, all of the children and youth of the world with all our lives ahead, but feeling awfully small and afraid. May I speak to you honestly with my heart and tell you my dream of dreams? And will you listen and hear my words, really hear them, not just in your minds, but in your heart, too?
Anne pours out her beautiful dream of peace, joy, love, and happiness. She ends with a plea to the world leaders.
If we don't dream this dream now, who can dream it for us later? If you, as leaders of the world, don't move to build this vision now, who will there be after you to take up the task? If the children of the world don't ask now for their birthright on this planet, who will ask for them later when their birthright is gone? If I don't find the words and the passion in my heart to ask you, to convince you, to stop the killing now, who can come after me to convince whoever comes after you to stop the killing then? We are all trembling with fear of the future because we are stealing it away, destroying it, when all we have to do, all we have to say is, we will stop doing that. We will stop killing the future. We will turn from the path of death to the highway of life. I think people can do that. I know they can do it if they just get the right pictures in their minds. They can do it if they remember the children, all the children of the world today, and the ones coming after them, and all the ones coming after them forever into the future, because there can be no future for the human family if there are no children, and there can be no children if people don't protect and care for the earth.
And now we get a beautiful scene of children stealing up on Anne, mysteriously coming out of the background behind. They are there in all colors and all races.
With a whoop, discovered, the children rush forward, dancing around Anne, jubilant, laughing, clutching for her dress, shouting for attention, amazed and delighted. Anne throws back her head, laughing, tossing her hair, hugging the first of the children to her tightly, then moving on, trying to touch everyone, kissing their cheeks, ruffling their hair. The childish voices have reached a crescendo of laughter, and shouting fills the room with their energy and joy. Half crying, half laughing, Anne turns to her audience, to the heads of government, of the nations of the world, and cries out, "Oh my! Look here. See the children of the future. Meet them, ladies and gentlemen. They've come to say hello."
And with that, the children rush out amongst the leaders of the world and cry out to them and call themselves the Kids of Hope. And it's a joyful, jubilant scene as the leaders finally begin to see what the future really means.
But then, with the searing suddenness, Charles Dickens sweeps back and reminds them of what the world is really like and what the future holds in store for the so-called Kids of Hope.
Oh, this is a piece that we don't like. But indeed, only a monster could like it. But it's what we're building towards.
It appears in the visioneering room as an unforgettable spectacle. It begins in the sky, looking down on an expanse of red desert, stretching away unaltered to the distant horizon, barren and lifeless. The scene moves closer, and a fissure appears, cutting across the expanse of desert, a rift darker in texture, with patches of green from trees clinging to the edges, and sunlight on the water in the valley below. In closer still, we see that it's an enormous canyon, 500 meters deep, 2 kilometers wide, cutting across the desert as far as the eye can see. Closer still, up to the rim of the canyon, looking down into its great expanse, an incredible scene unfolds.
On each wall of the canyon, a winding trail snakes down from the top to the floor. Moving along the trails, like two streams of black ants to a honeypot, an unaccountable mass of children. Pouring down, materializing from nowhere, on the top, massing on either side of the rushing river at the bottom, spreading out, filling the valley floor to its full width of 2 kilometers. They move forward, a listless army of small people, all ages, from babies to teens, pouring into the valley, fed from 2 never-ending streams coming down the canyon wall. It's an incomprehensible and compressed mass of small humanity, moving forward the front rank already far out of sight, far up the canyon floor, while the numbers continue to swell from behind.
The scene moves along above the heads of the slowly trudging children, the big ones carrying the little ones, everyone in tattered rags or naked, emaciated limbs, hollow, gaunt faces, all colors, white, black, chocolate brown, yellow, contrasting ethnic features, just like before a few minutes ago in the visioneering room, but in every other way, nothing is the same. These children move like lifeless automatons, without energy, totally without hope. The numbers are incredible, incomprehensible to the human mind.
The scene continues to move along over their heads, searching for the front ranks. 5 kilometers. 10. Still no end to it. Around innumerable turns in the canyon's formation. 15 kilometers. 20. There has to be an end, but there isn't. 22. 23. 24. Up ahead. Yes, there's an end of it. The front ranks treading forward, coming to a sharp drop in the valley floor where the river plunges over a waterfall 100 meters high, and the drop extends across the whole 2 kilometers width of the valley floor. So there's no getting around it. The end of the journey, a precipitous drop to nowhere, and the front ranks have come up to it.
They halt, staring listlessly over the precipice. No emotion. No reaction, just standing there, waiting, while the numbers fill in behind. 25 kilometers of children, each one taking up a half square meter of space, 2 children per square meter filling an area 25 kilometers long by 2 kilometers wide, 25,000 meters by 2,000 meters, 50 million square meters with 2 children per square meter, 100 million children massed on the floor of the canyon with no way forward, and the numbers are still being fed from a continuous stream behind.
The scene hangs there in center space of the visioneering room, burning into the minds of the world leaders forced to watch. Charles Dickens speaks again, his voice now low and sharply incisive.
In a world where the leaders are preoccupied with politics, weapons, competition, unemployment, and national debt, children conceived in faith for the future quickly become the children without hope. Incremental statistics in government reports, occasional sensational copy for the media when crises develop. Victims of preventable diseases, avoidable famines, unnecessary wars, unconscionable adult neglect and abuse, their numbers mount over a decade of too little caring and too much incompetence. 100 million wasted lives, 10 million a year for 10 years, 100 million lost souls massed there in front of your eyes so you can see what the statistics mean. 25 kilometers of young human flesh, each one a living being, born with the most incredible faculties of knowing, speaking, imagining, feeling, caring, loving, trusting, innocent, and vulnerable before their parents and their governments. These are the children of the future who have no future. They are an abomination to our sight, an affront to our conscience. Let us sweep them away.
With that, a deep, rumbling roar is heard in the distance, building slowly while the children in the canyon pack in closely, giving one another what small comfort they can. If they hear the roar, they pay no attention. Their movements remain as listless and as automatic as before. The scene tilts a little so that the onlookers can see up the valley beyond the point where the children are entering. The roar has been building steadily, reaching a crescendo now that implodes the eardrums. Then the source of sound sweeps into view, a wall of water 20 meters high, sweeping down the valley, churning brown and ugly in its ferocity, tossing trees and boulders around like toys, bearing down with savage intensity on the living carpet of helpless children in its path. In a moment, it has hit the back of the pack and sweeps over them and adds their tiny bodies to the boiling maelstrom of objects in its path. Forward it goes on its awful journey, where even at a speed of 100 kilometers an hour, it takes many minutes to gather and destroy such an incredible number of living souls while the leaders of the world look on. Finally, it's done. The wall of water has swept the landscape clean of all the children, 100 million of them engulfed by its fury. Behind, the river settles again into its former course, and two unending streams of children continue to file down the canyon walls onto the valley floor. The scene fades. The spotlight returns to Charles Dickens, standing defiantly in front of his audience.
Suffer the little children to come into the world, then blot out their tiny lives in misery and death before they have a chance to know what they might be. Then talk in the same breath about progress and development. What progress and development can the world claim in the face of the gigantic horror of those wasted lives?
As if anything could be more horrible, Dickens now takes them on a kaleidoscopic sweep of violence, crime, depravity, ecological devastation, rioting against governments and politicians. Finally, he speaks directly to the leaders in the room.
Leaders of the world, what future do you choose for the world? What leadership will you bring to bear to ensure the best possible outcome? Will you stand tall, wise, and tolerant? Will you seek with unremitting determination to search in your mind, in company with your colleagues, to find a vision for the future that all can share and say, yes, this is right for the world, because it values above all the preservation of life and the opportunity for every soul to live that life with dignity and honor? What you have seen here are not the shadows of what will be. They are the shadows only of what may be. But they are certainly the shadows of what will be if you do not choose quickly to turn away from the actions that will bring them to pass. We have chosen here to show you where you are going, where you and your governments are taking the world. We do not like what we see any more than you now seem to like it yourselves. Thus we stand on the threshold of future possibility rather than future foreclosed. There is more to show you, but my part in it for the moment has been done. I leave you now with the image and the thought of what you now might do when you are returned to your own dominion of power.
With that, the spotlight on Dickens snaps off and he is gone. In his place, the tall glass tower of the United Nations building in New York zooms into view and dissolves into the empty room of the General Assembly. The image sharpens in intensity, moves closer, and becomes a mirror image of the visioneering room, save that the General Assembly remains empty, waiting for the delegates to return. A deep, unbroken silence embraces all.